Welcome to the Specialty Coffee Podcast, Season 2. This is episode number 2. We have a very special guest on. This will be our first ever coffee farmer who is leasing a coffee farmer. We have on Mauricio Botero with Botero Coffee Club. And but Mauricio, we are just so excited to have you on, man. Thanks for hopping on the episode.
It's been a long time coming. Super excited.
How long have we been talking about getting you on the show? A couple months at least?
At least, yeah. And then you and I have been chatting for well over a year, I think, ever since our mutual connection, Rob Peary, kind of connected us all together after I had done his podcast.
I think when I first met you, I didn't even know that you were into the coffee farm and owning it and all that kind of stuff. I think we had talked back and forth. And then when I heard you had the farm, I was like, dude, I got to have you on the show. But that's when we took a break between season 1 and 2. So I'm stoked to have you on, man. You're our first guest of season 2 outside of my wife. So
all right. Hopefully I can definitely, you know, provide a lot of value here and make it worthwhile, man.
Oh, dude, it'll be awesome. So let's talk a little bit about your background, kind of what got you into specialty coffee and how did this kind of journey begin for you?
Yeah, absolutely. First and foremost, I am Colombian. I cannot be more Colombian. I mean, if you Google my last name, the first thing that'll show up is a famous painter. He is definitely somewhere in my family tree. It's in there. I don't know him, and you know, he actually just passed recently. But so I grew up in Miami, born and raised in Miami, in a bubble of Colombians and Cubans, and coffee's part of the culture. You know, you grow up drinking café con leche. That's 4 or 5 years old. That's a normal thing, right? So
yeah.
But that's as much as I knew. Oh yeah. Lots of sugar, lots of milk with lots of love. And, you know, we always joke in Miami, even if you're not Hispanic, you're going to be drinking Cuban coffee. Like it is just part of the culture, the work culture, the party culture.
Sure.
And, it's rocket fuel. So I joined the Marine Corps at 18. I decided to actually leave Miami on purpose. I know people sometimes think I'm crazy for wanting to leave there, but, when I got to Virginia, when I got to Quantico, that was my first experience in kind of the workplace culture of the military coffee lifestyle. Hmm. You know, the blacker, the better, just, you know, the
stronger.
It's putting hair on your chest, like what people used to say. And it wasn't great.
Yeah,
I was still drinking it with milk and coffee. You know, fast forward, I got into, after I left the active duty ranks, I joined the reserves and got a real professional job in IT. So I'm an IT guy by trade, and I got into sales IT. And that's when I really started seeing specialty coffee, traveling around the country, going to awesome places like where the parts where you live, California, even up in a lot of where the Navy is, the Marine Corps, places like where those bases are. I got to experience some of that new specialty coffee scene, and I could afford it. Mm-hmm. And it was around the time my palate was growing up too, like in my mid to late 20s. So liking bourbon, starting to drink a lot of wine, starting to appreciate cigars a little bit more. I kind of, you know, as I was maturing, associated, well, I should up my coffee game a little bit now that I have the ability to spend some money on some nicer things, and it'll let me talk with people and connect with people some more. And that's when it really started. And it was probably, we don't have specialty coffee shops where I live right next to Quantico. It's not a thing. But in Washington, D.C. it is. In Richmond, very great coffee scene there. But really around my work travels is when I really got to dive into specialty coffee.
That's awesome. It's fascinating. I think a lot of, I saw a post recently about the wine industry and how we can thank the wine industry for like coffee's processing methods. And I'm always fascinated because I think in the same ways that we develop a palate for like wine and bourbon and cigars, we develop a palate for coffee. Do you think that was the same thing for you as you were kind of exploring quote unquote the finer things in life?
Yes, but there's something that didn't happen with bourbon, wine, maybe a little bit of wine that did happen with coffee. And I think you've even talked about this. I remember hearing one of your shows with someone where when you have that, what could be a great cup of coffee for your first time, like, let me show you the way. And you go and drink that first, I don't know, that first fruity natural from Ethiopia or something. And all you've been drinking is crud all your life. You go, what is this?
Right.
That didn't happen with me with bourbon. That didn't happen with me with cigars. It was a little more nuanced. It took some time. With coffee, it was, I mean, that first or second really good cup of coffee, I could tell what is this? Why is this different? I want more. Well, man, it's expensive. You know, you started really figuring that out at that point.
You quickly. That is fascinating because I think it's less of a progression, like you're saying, with specialty coffee, and it's more of like an aha moment. I think some people in the industry talk about like, oh, what was your aha moment with coffee? So it is interesting that it's kind of a flip for people. And once you're in the rabbit hole, man, you're goner. So, which can be a money
Absolutely.
suck too. So if you're buying a bunch of expensive specialty coffees and get all the gear, you know, and all that kind of stuff, but.
Yep.
So you got into specialty coffee kind of with your travels while you're in the Marines. Also, thank you for your service and what you've done for our
Oh,
country and all
thanks.
that. I seriously appreciate it. So, and then how did you kind of get into owning a coffee farm? I mean, that seems like a huge leap from liking specialty coffee. So how did you kind of progress from there?
Yeah, that is definitely a huge leap. So, a lot of my family still lives in Colombia. I got so many aunts and uncles and cousins, like a good Colombian. I got 40 cousins. Some of them I don't even
Awesome.
know. But my father still lives in Colombia to this day. So I still travel to Colombia to visit anyways. So that's a big part of how we got there. And I started getting into real estate investing as well on the side. You know, I'm really big on entrepreneurship. As I got into kind of like my early 30s and my late 20s, early 30s, I'm like, I don't want to work forever. So I saw real estate investing as one of those vehicles that I was going to choose and on how to do this. And then as I got started in that, you know, I started investing in some single family properties. And I was always talking to my coworkers in sales who are, I always joke, they're lazy and they have a lot of money, right? I would always joke with them and say, come on, invest with me, invest with me. And, you know, some of them, I got a couple to say yes, and we partnered on some deals. A lot of them said no, you know, maybe one day later. And I would also talk to them all the time about my trips to Colombia, right? Like, look at my trips to Colombia. My summers are going to Quindío, Colombia, where my family's from. The main city there is called Armenia. And I go visit my dad, and I go visit my cousin and his farm, and I go visit my other uncle and his farm up the mountains, and look at these awesome pictures of me riding a horse and, you know, drinking amazing coffee. And a lot of my coworkers would say, hey, I'm not going to invest with you, but if you do something in Colombia, you let me know. I would love to do your experience that you do with your family in Colombia. Like, let me go with you. If you ever invest in anything there, let me know. So that kind of
Interesting.
planted a bug. And I got pitched as an investor into investing in a coffee farm co-op thing in Panama. And it was, you know, you buy a slice of land, sublotted, it's yours, it's titled in your name, but we co-op manage it, farm it for you, and it's just a passive investment for you. And it sounded awesome, but my ego was kind of telling me, man, screw that. Why am I going to go to Panama? I'm Colombian. I have all this family in Colombia in coffee country. If you look up Quindío, Colombia, it is literally in the coffee triangle. It's a very famous World Heritage site for coffee, if you've never heard of it, for any of your listeners. And so then I got interested in an investment that was run by a group of really sophisticated American entrepreneurs in Colombia, a coffee farm deal where they were going to raise capital all in a big collective capital and disrupt the coffee industry in Colombia. And it's a great project, great investment. But again, my ego told me, why would I do that? You know, there's, I don't know, it's just a bunch of American. I mean, I'm Colombian American, but you know, these are a bunch of outsiders in Colombia, and my ego was telling me, come on, I could do this. So I just talked to my dad about it, and he said, you know, you could do that. Like, you know, your uncle is a coffee consultant. You know, your
Oh, no
prima,
kidding.
your cousin is a real estate attorney for coffee farms. You know, your. So the rabbit hole just started going down the rabbit hole, and around the same time, the final linchpin was talking to this one real estate investor mentor that I was talking to a lot. And I wanted to get to really big and deals in real estate. And he's like, what are you doing, man? Just go invest with your dad. 'Cause I was telling him, you know, I really need to do something with my dad. Like, I have not spent a lot of time with my dad in my adulthood. And he's like, why don't you go do something with your dad? And that was the final straw that broke the camel's back. I'm like, I'm doing this. And so that's how it started, man. Just one thing led to another. And every time I kept trying to learn more and thinking I was close enough to do something, I said to myself, oh my God, I don't know anything. I gotta learn more. I gotta find the next person. I gotta find the right resource. Like, I just don't know enough to actually invest anybody's money, let alone my own.
Yeah.
And that really, really started in full force in January of 2021, I think.
Okay.
And then here we are now, 2 years later, and I actually pulled the trigger, and we have Botero Coffee Club headquarters in Quindío, Colombia.
Dude, that's amazing. So congratulations, first and foremost, on owning a coffee farm in Quindío, where your family's from. I mean, that's got to just give you a lot of pride and sense of ownership in the fact that, you know, you're doing it in your hometown, in where you're from, and you're investing back in your family. You mentioned that you had a lot of family that was in coffee. You said your uncle was a coffee consultant. Did you have family members or friends that were farmers, and did you chat with them about what they needed or what they were doing? How did the kind of connections in that, in your family sense, work?
Yeah, that's how it started for sure. So as I had entrepreneurship in Colombia in mind with my future trips now, when I would go to visit my family, you know, my dad would say, all right, we got this lined up. We're going to go visit this person, this person, this person. So one of the first people I really spent a lot of time with was my dad's best friend. So he's kind of like family at this point. His name is Pacho. Shout out to Pacho if you're ever going to listen to this. And Pacho is a really ingrained coffee professional consultant in Quindío, Colombia. So he originally had a farm outside. He had just bought a new coffee farm in Quindío in a town called Genoa. It's spelled Genova, but it's pronounced in Spanish, Genoa.
Genoa, okay.
And he was the first resource I really just dove deep into. So I'm bilingual, so I speak fluent Spanish, right? So that's one of my, you know, definitely my superpowers here, my competitive advantages as I'm doing this, is that, you know, I can speak the language, and he only speaks Spanish.
Right.
So I was just bombarding him with questions and, of course, you know, just talking to him all the time. And he was gracious to help me. One of the things that he does as a coffee consultant is help people like me quote out, spec out, what does it take to build or buy a coffee farm? That's literally one of the things he does as a service for people both in Colombia or on the outside. So as I did that, he answered my original very high-level questions, things like, how much profit does a coffee farm make? Like, how do you even estimate that?
So as you were starting to, as you were meeting with your uncle's, or excuse me, it was your dad's friend, best friend, right?
Dad's best friend, yep.
Yep. So as you're meeting with your dad's best friend, what kind of metrics and questions were you asking and looking to as you were kind of getting ready to make that first step?
So the first thing that we were talking about was, what is the amount of capital needed, or what size farm is a kind of the sweet spot where it's worth doing this so that it's profitable? And his question, my question was answered with his, one of his questions was, well, what kind of coffee are you trying to grow? Hmm. Right? If you're trying to grow commodity grade, Federación de Colombia, you know, basic coffee, it's going to require a bigger farm. You're going to have to do it in higher volume, right? But if you're truly talking about specialty coffee only, and I'm telling him some of the prices as I'm talking, as I had been talking to roasters about what they might buy their green beans for.
Yeah.
You know, he's going, oh my God, that's incredible, right? So with that in mind, if you give me kind of like what the target price of what you, the coffee you grow might sell for, well, then this is how much of the ballpark of the land and the capital to buy the machines and the equipment and the improvements in order to buy a coffee farm that should be profitable.
Okay.
And this is with no loans. In Colombia, it is, I think the metric, I just saw this the other day, I think the metric is only 5%, 5 or 10% of all homes in Colombia are mortgaged. It is not typical to use loans. It's very hard, it's very difficult to get loans and mortgages, let alone for a brand new business, right? So I was only going to start this business with capital. But that's also one of the reasons why I was doing this idea, is because to buy a beautiful piece of real estate and on the tip of a beautiful mountain in Quindío, Colombia, it's only like $75,000 to $150,000.
Wow.
Like what we as Americans would imagine that amazing farm property that I show in my Instagram pictures, and people always ask me, how much does that cost? I'm like, that farm was offered to me for, I don't know, I'm just making up a number, $100,000.
Yeah.
And people just lose their minds, right? So it's because of that, that it makes sense in order to not have to bring in a huge debt to start a business, right?
Yeah,
so
Totally.
That's definitely one of the first things is, you know, what is that sweet spot of how much money do I need to bring to buy the right size farm in order to even make this thing work?
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. When you were talking, Pacho?
Pacho, yeah. Pacho. So Fernando in Colombia, a lot of nicknames for Fernando is Pacho.
Pacho, okay. So when you were talking with Pacho, what kind of varietals were you looking to, were they already pre-existing, and what kind of specialty coffees and varietals were you kind of honing in on for Candia Coffee?
The Caturas, the Colombia varietal, there's a varietal called Colombia. Those are some of the typical ones in the specialty scene that I was seeing. But as I started looking more and more, he was able to find some farms that already had pre-existing lots of pink Bourbon, yellow Bourbon.
Yeah.
The geishas were starting to pop up. This was back in 2021. So in Quindío, I was starting to see some more geishas. And we also saw some, there's not that much sidra in in Quindío. But yeah, but those are the main ones.
Yeah. And what varietals do you have on your farm now that you've bought on the property and everything? What do you got going?
So we have bought Catura, Colombia, Senecafe, and we have one fermentation that our producer partner, Sarah, is doing, where she's using the mosto from Pink Bourbon, which is like the fermented juice that comes out from the process. Oh, wow. To cross mix it with a yellow, I think it's with the Columbia varietal.
Wow, that's awesome. Well, I feel like we're jumping ahead, but I'm super excited. Don't let me forget to ask you about that.
For sure.
That sounds incredible. So you find a piece of land that's gorgeous, first of all. And it's an awesome property with not a huge capital investment in terms of like what we think of here in America for property. So you kind of pull the trigger on the land and say, hey, that's what I want. What other metrics and things were you looking into to make sure that you were ready to go before you kind of pulled the trigger and said, hey, this is the farm I want. Let's do it.
Another main thing was the access to roads. So as I talked to farmers and coffee farm owners, even that are in the United States, you know, I would see sometimes they're in some more remote parts of Antioquia or, you know, closer to like, or in the outskirts of Medellin, which is a big city in Colombia. And I remember a lot of the stories where because of the roads, a lot of farmers, the road washes out, you know, they don't have enough money to fix the road. If they had more money with specialty coffee, they'd be able to fix the road. But in order to have more money, they need to be able to make specialty coffee. Yeah. So I would hear a lot of stories of that cycle that they were in. And I wanted no part of that. Yeah. And so one of my things was I'm really looking for a farm that has a decent or really good pre-existing road, either that's already paved or that's somewhat paved. Also because I had tourism and ecotourism in mind as part of the larger vision. I want to bring my roasters as I'm meeting with me. I want to bring friends that want to maybe invest with me. And I want to build Airbnbs or short-term rentals on a farm that I'm going to build one day. So I really didn't want... there's a Spanish word for when Colombians go on these back country roads up to their coffee farms for the weekend. And I mean, you're just bumping around in these little Jeeps and these little pickup trucks. Yeah. And it's part of like the culture. And it's, you know, this is how it is, but I can't imagine bringing my American friends on these roads for 45 minutes where they may not even be able to get to the farm. That was definitely one of the requirements.
Sure.
And I had to have a view. It had to have a view. Like that's the number one critical requirement was we have to have a view or else it all hinges. I can't move the farm. Yeah, right? I can build anything, but I can't move it wherever it is that I buy it.
Yeah. Wherever coffee is going to produce and grow well and the varietals you're wanting to do and all that stuff, like, you know, you can't pick that up. Obviously you can, you know, move an Airbnb, but the farm is going to be where the farm's at. So. Okay, exactly. So you got the land. It had good, you know, good roadways and stuff where you're not going to get your brain thrashed on the way coming in or out or not be able to export coffee, you know, coming out once it's been picked and everything. Was there the mill? Because you have a mill on the property. Is that correct?
Correct. We're there. We have a abandoned mill that we took over.
Okay.
That we're turning into a rehabbed, revitalized wet and dry mill.
That's awesome. And so was there a pre, there was a farm already on the property, and there was at one point in time a mill, and then that kind of shut down. Do you know the history about the land and everything?
I do. So okay, cool. We ended up getting a tip as we were frustrated that we lost out on a piece of land in a town called Barcelona, mm-hmm. and kind of like the one in Spain, it's called Barcelona. And we were looking at buying this lot to build from scratch a wet and dry mill, a state-of-the-art, small but state-of-the-art, brand new wet and dry mill to service both our own needs and the needs of the surrounding area, which we saw as we started looking into this. Oh, wow, there's not a dry mill that's able to handle the load and the requirements that's needed for dry mill in this area. We were originally not going to build our own mill. We were originally going to outsource dry milling first and then get to it later. But then as we did that, we saw we were going to need to do ourselves. So we were all bummed. We missed out on the slot. It wasn't just going to work out. My dad goes into town to drink coffee with his old buddy, Bernardo. My dad's pretty old. He's in his, sorry, dad. He's in his mid-70s. And so is Don Bernardo. And he's like, yeah, you know, my son and I, we missed out. I'm glad we didn't buy the lot. It wasn't going to work out. Bernardo says to him, you know, I have an old farm right down the street, right? You know, it's like 5 minutes out of the outskirts of town. So yeah, you know, I have a mill there. I just haven't used it in 10 years. I shut it down 10 wow. years ago. I had a heart attack. I was in the coffee business when the commodity prices dropped. You know, it made coffee not profitable for me in my scale that I was doing it. So I got out of it and I got sick, and my kids are all grown up and they, you know, they did their own professions. They're not in the coffee business. So I just shut it down. You want to go check it out? And my dad, you know, oh my gosh, yes, yeah, let's go right yeah. now. So that's how this ended up really, this was in June. Things turned real quickly. We did a hard pivot in June. Yeah. And both my father and my business partner in Colombia, I partnered with Botero Coffee Club, which is three owners, myself, Luke, and Tucker. We okay. partnered with a guy named Diane in Colombia, and he is a coffee processing nerd. As much as I'm a nerd in spreadsheets, he is a nerd in spreadsheets and coffee. He knows down to the cell how to calculate the profitability of a coffee farm, a wet mill, dry mill, processing protocol methods, what your yield can be. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
So we made him a part owner of the Colombian business. And so we sent him and my dad to the facility, and they were just blown away. It was like a time capsule, a very dusty, dirty sure. cobweb time capsule. But in this facility that hadn't been used for 10 years was still the facility itself is huge, great structure, just mm-hmm. needs a lot of loving care, a lot of TLC. And so, yeah, that's how that started in June on what is it going to take to get this up and running and to our what our end product in mind, which is really high quality specialty coffee at high volume, as high as volume as you can without sacrificing quality. Sure. What is it going to take to be able to achieve that?
That's awesome, man. So when you said you partnered with a guy who's super into like spreadsheets and profitability on farming and everything, do you feel like that's a key that may be missing in the specialty coffee industry or just the coffee industry in general? And a key to their success is just potentially like a lack of education or a lack of resources to kind of have those metrics and that understanding of like, hey, if we change this or this, we'd then become more profitable. And is there just not that education around like, hey, here's how to make a profitable coffee farm and production and mill?
It's a combination of a lot of these things and also okay. a little bit of the money and capital thing too, and the access sure. to the specialty coffee markets for the buyers, for okay. buyers to find who these people are. So I saw this firsthand, like after talking to, you know, people within my first circle that I was talking to about how to buy coffee farms, what makes sense, what's profitable, I started quickly learning some of the questions I was asking wasn't getting answered about, you know, numbers and ROI and how to calculate the profitability of a farm in a more professional way with spreadsheets and things like that. Sure. I was getting a lot of the universal sign, you know, for the audio listeners here, the hands up, like, I don't know, yeah. I haven't done that. And, you know, I also kind of started associating that a little bit with a little bit of the older crowd versus, as just a comparison, you know, Diane, who is a college educated 20 something year old who went to school for business and coffee. And then also got his Q certification in processing as well. So it's night and day. It's not the same. So part of it is like what you said with that, with the knowledge and the education. I will say though, as I learn more, the resources are there. Both for the regional coffee growers, anybody, the Colombian Coffee Grower Federation is very, very focused on helping to make sure coffee is successful in Colombia, no matter what. No matter what the C price is in New York, right? And specialty coffee obviously is one of those ways to get coffee farmers more into that. But also there's individual women's associations. There's individual associations for different ethnic groups. Like, you know, there's actually natives, native Colombians who are not from the Spanish descent. Like there's a lot of specialty coffee focused support groups that give all the resource and all the help. But then it comes back to money and capital and breaking that cycle where, you know, it's all great and dandy that you tell me that there's gringos, like we say gringos for Americans as a joke, as in Colombia. You know, there's gringos that are willing to buy your carbonic maceration, Mauricio, for $25 a bag. Like that's great. But I would have to buy so much more fermentation tanks and this and that. And I would have to put so much more money into labor to do really, really great, you know, fungicides and fertilizer and where you treat a plant, where you cut it in certain, and you prune it in certain places to make sure the growth works really well. That's a lot of work and a lot of labor, skilled labor, more skilled labor, right? And a lot of capital and a lot of materials that I have to buy. How am I going to afford that to make the specialty coffee so that I can then afford what I just did? So there's a little bit of a chicken and an egg scenario. That's it's a combination of a lot of that.
Yeah. So what do you think would be the solution? Or like you said, the chicken before the egg, what do you think should come first? And how do you think you can help educate and kind of impact the specialty coffee in Cadea? Like what is the missing key here? What's the element? Like, what do you feel like you could impact now owning a farm and partnering with the people you've partnered with? What do you feel like there's some aha moments or some hard learned lessons you've had kind of early on?
I think that, and I'm using two resources of mine as kind of like my moral compass and my guide here. So number one is, if your listeners have listened or read this book, Carl Weinhold, Cheap Coffee, if you've read that book before or heard about him, he's kind of that that first kind of moral compass to keep me on the straight and narrow, because I am for profit, right? But I'm doing this to help Quindío. I want to put Quindío Coffee on the map. I want to help my family, friends, and people who I've met. I want their coffee to get to my coffee roaster stores in the United States for self-servingly so I could drink it, but then also so they can really, you know, break a little bit of this chicken and the egg, right? And then another one is there's a nonprofit community wet mill project around where this is in Colombia. This guy, Miguel Fajardo, if you ever look up Raw Phoenix, and they have an awesome project where they're trying to help in their way by saying, farmers come to us, we'll give you the education, we know the end market, so we'll bring you customers, or, you know, we'll at least get you closer to some of these customers, and we'll help you with your fermentation processes, how to do natural things like that. We'll help you dry mill, we'll help you be able to do really good selection, things like that. So using those two kind of compasses, that's how I see starting it, is by having a wet and dry mill. That first, for the wet mill, I'm going to buy the raw materials, so the coffee cherries, from farmers at a better price than what they could sell it themselves. If they get our guidance, our expertise on processing methods, fumigation, fertilization, on how to prune properly, you know, our resources, our technical resources will help them in advance so that they can produce our raw product for us. We're going to buy their coffee at a better price than what they are selling right now. And it allows them to focus on what they're doing first, which is growing really great coffee, and not having to also have the fermentation tanks on site and also have, you know, really great floating systems and all this other stuff. Right, let them be able to change a little bit of the dynamics, start making more profit without having to do all this other stuff that they can't do without someone giving them a huge loan. And then the second thing I'm doing is the dry mill service. So we're dry milling for our own coffee, but then also for the local community with specialty coffee in mind, making sure we're doing it really well. You know, there's a difference, and I experienced this firsthand. There's a difference between getting your coffee dry milled by a third party service that kind of does it decently, or you don't know what's going to happen, versus one who follows really strict standards of how much coffee input do you get outputted.
Right.
That's quality controlled. And that's a huge way to, you know, if I'm going to sell my coffee to insert the best names here of coffee roasters, of boutique coffee roasters in the US, you got to be damn sure that stuff is really, really well selected and, mm-hmm. and milled, and it's got to be of high quality. So that's another way we're doing it too.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And I think it's cool because, you know, earlier I asked you, like, what are some of the biggest, like, missing keys or elements? Is it education? Is it resources? Whatever. And you're kind of filling that gap and that need of saying, hey, listen, instead of having to input all this capital and get all these resources and buy all these things and get all the skilled labor, I'll do that for you. And I'm also going to provide you the education that's going to, one, increase profits for you. You're going to get better selection. You're going to get better, higher yields, and all that kind of stuff. And then I'm going to kind of house that wet mill for you. So that in return, then I get better, you know, better cherries coming to me. I get better yields and all that kind of stuff. And then we're able to do the processing methods that you wouldn't typically do on your own farm. So that's awesome, man.
And I mean, it's also to conversation I kept having with my dad and my business partner in Colombia was, you know, you don't want to be the guy, at least it's different for me, right? I am Colombian. My last name cannot be more Colombian. And,
right.
But they all know I'm gringo, right? Like I am not born and raised there. So right. I don't want to be the guy who comes in and tries to buy hundreds of thousands of hectares of coffee farms. Most coffee farms in Colombia, I think the statistic is a pretty common number that people throw around. But I think it's 90 to 95% of all coffee growers in Colombia own 10 hectares or less.
Wow.
The vast majority of all coffee grown in Colombia is grown by small farmers.
Interesting.
By family, yeah. Small families, you know, things like that, right? So in order to scale, to be able to one day be able to provide coffee to the bigger players that, you know, I have the vision of doing one day, I don't, the math didn't work out very well. To become like an empire builder of owning hundreds of thousands of coffee farms. So the other way to scale would be to just buy people's raw products. So it is a big part of that is absolutely one of the reasons why I'm doing that.
No, that's awesome. So you purchased the farm. Were you starting out dry milling to like you were having your own coffee that was grown on the farm then dry milled elsewhere, correct? Initially?
No. So initially a year ago, it's been a year now, okay. My coffee producing friend, her name is Sarah Gutierrez. She makes some amazing coffee. And as I got some of her samples sent to me and brought to roasters that I was traveling around and meeting, this is actually how Rob Peary and I first kind of met and started talking was with her samples. He was like, what is this carbonic maceration? This is amazing. This is really good. You know, roasters were just loving this stuff that she was producing. And of course the story, right? Like Sarah, she's amazing. Fifth generation. She went to school for microbiology and coffee. She's the real deal. You could talk to her. She speaks English. It's the, you know, it's not the dream, but it's the ideal thing that roasters tell me that they want. They want to, you know, one day be able to have really as close to direct, trade with the farmers that they can get. And so I said, all right, I'm going to buy 1,000 pounds of her coffee. I bought half of it in wash process and half of it in this natural process that she does that's carbonic maceration.
Yeah.
And that's how I first started, was buying her coffee. I had it milled. I had it quality controlled. I had it cupped before it left. Mm-hmm. I had it shipped and exported by a third party. And then when it arrived to stateside, I had it trucked and brought to my business partner's house. And that's where we started getting to the business of testing the market, right? Seeing if roasters are going to like this and if using this as the, you know, the pilot project, right? The pilot product that this is what we can produce at scale and repetitively. That's really how we started, even before the dry mill now is just coming online.
Okay, cool. So you talked about samples. Also, I got some samples sent before we did this episode, and I've got to say your packaging is incredible. So the presentation is awesome. I'm going to try to show this box as best that I can, but in here we've got two bags. So you sent me the carbonic maceration, which you were just talking about. And then I also have the Finca El Silencio from Buena Vista, which is ironic because that's where I live here in Colorado. Shout out.
It's almost meant to be. Look at that.
I guess so. But yeah, it comes in these. And this is, you said 500 grams, right? Or 1,000? I can't remember.
I sent 500 grams of each, I believe.
Of each, yep. And it comes in this awesome, like, you did the small burlap bags in here. There's a sticker. There's a card. There's a pamphlet. Direct trade, sustainably sourced Colombian coffee. Yeah, man, you guys, you crushed it with the samples and everything. I can't wait to throw it in our bullet roaster and give it a shot. We'll definitely be picking up some coffee. So you bought 1,000 pounds of the carbonic maceration, or 50-50, right? Half washed, half carbonic maceration. Was that the first coffee that you kind of imported and brought into America? And how was that process?
Yes, yes. And a lot of lessons learned. I'll tell you a crazy story that happened there. So yeah, that's the first one that we bought. I have brought in other samples before in the past, but that's the first bulk coffee that I bought. I had to make a first decision I had to make was how to package it. So my sourcing partner in Colombia, I partnered with someone named Juan Diaz. Shout out to Juan. He's been an incredible resource for me. He's in the barista competition scene. He's also a roaster. He's a Miami kid like me, younger, but also Colombian. So he's then since moved back to Colombia to run his business from there. And one of the best things that he helps me with is a partnership that he has with a team called CoTrade. Shout out to CoTrade. Those guys are awesome. They work in Colombia to source coffees and other countries too. And so they were working with me a deal where we would co-container, package my coffee in their container that they had. Because, hey, if you have a container, you know, the economics of the pounds per the fee of having the container of shipping it over, it drops the more coffee you fit in there, right? So there's only, you know, you got to send coffee over in a container. Well, you might as well fill it up as much as possible. So that's what I did. I filled up one pallet in that container with our coffee.
Awesome.
And he helped me quality control it at the dry mill in Medellin. That's where he lives and that's where he works out of. And then they did all the coordination for me. So it was completely outsourced for me. What had happened was, this was in January when it was finally leaving. And
January
Colombia,
2022?
January 2023.
23, this year. Got it.
Yep. So to buy coffee from farmers in Colombia, one of the reasons why direct trade in Colombia is a lot harder than it sounds is because it's Colombian farmers don't really accept dollars. They just don't. That's not a thing, right? You can't swipe a credit card over PayPal and buy their coffee. The transaction, for the most part, you know, I'm sure there's exceptions, has to happen in pesos, Colombian pesos, in Colombia. They have to pay tax on it. There's kind of like here in the States, right? We you know, if a Colombian person is going to buy goods and services from us here in the States, we're going to be like, we're going to charge you in dollars.
Right.
So one of the things that he provided me, and then now with my own, I finally have my own company in Colombia, so I can do this now, is helping to facilitate providing me the service of buying the coffee, him sourcing the coffee, QCing it, milling it, and helping with the exportation of it.
Oh, cool.
And all I had to do was provide dollars, and then he, with his own business, right, was able to translate that and provide that service to me. So he negotiated, paid the farmer, paid for the trucks to move it from Quindío to Medellín, and then the trucks to the port. Wow. One thing that happened, though, was when it got to the port, if you guys want to do a quick geography lesson, trivia fact, Colombia borders two oceans. It borders the Pacific on the west and the Caribbean in the north. Panama splits it down the middle. And I'm on the east coast in Virginia, and we were going to get our coffee shipped to New Jersey for whatever the reasons were. And the most logical route is to go out of the port of Cartagena, which if you've never been to Cartagena, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And to go over the Caribbean Sea to New Jersey. Well, when the truck got to the port, they said, no, sir, we're on strike. We're not shipping anything. We're on strike. Doing it.
Yeah.
So weeks passed by, and then finally the trucks got reverted all the way. Colombia's a big country. All the way back to the west side of the country on the port of the Pacific. It went up the Pacific Ocean through the Panama Canal, and then back up to New Jersey.
Oh my gosh! Yeah.
So, needless to say, my my exportation cost per pound went up pretty significantly.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah, talk about it. There's so many steps in the process. Like, it's one of those things that you just never realize or think about as a consumer here in the United States, of like all the little steps that it actually takes to get your coffee into your hands, right? Which I think is a huge part of like why we chose the name Storyline. We kind of talked about that last week, of just like there's so many hands that touch it and so many unforeseen things that can happen, right? I mean, you know, you're never expecting that there's a random strike in the port of Cartagena, you know, and that your coffee's going to have to be take a huge, you know, detour to then get where it needs to go, right? But the reality is there's drivers, there's people that bag the coffee, there's, it's got to go, you know, on so many steps and journeys just to get imported. And then once it's imported, it's got to be bagged, and then samples have to be sent out. And, you know, there's a lot of little steps that people don't realize that goes into the final step of drinking our morning cup of Joe.
For sure. I couldn't agree with you more. And that's kind of back to a comment I said earlier. Every time I thought I was close enough, I realized, no, I need to learn more. I need to talk to somebody else, or, you know, and then with kind of some business principles in mind that I've been hearing, let me outsource, like, what's the quickest way to profit to get a most minimum viable product first?
Right.
And outsourcing is the way to go, right? Leveraging other people. If you've ever heard the mantra, like who, not how, it's who do I need to find in order to do this step and that step and that step. And that's how I ended up doing that first deal and getting that coffee shipped over here.
That's awesome. So you get your first coffee in. How much, like, how has it been now that you bought 1,000 pounds? That was your first lot. 500 pounds of the wash, 500 pounds of the carbonic maceration. And like, how has it gone now that you've imported it, you've got it to the United States? Like, what are you guys now looking to do now that you've got Potero Coffee Club here? What's the next step for you?
Yeah, so the next step is twofold. I mean, we've been bugged by our friends and family, me and my two other business partners, for months and months and months and months. Like, when can I buy some coffee? When can I buy some coffee? And, you know, first we have to differentiate between the people that want to drink it versus the roasters that we want to buy green.
Right.
And we realized pretty quickly, all right, we have to get some roasted coffee out there as we're trying to sell our green coffee to roasters. So coming up with clever packaging, coming up with something that sticks out. You know, one of the things that you and I talked about, you know, behind the scenes, is there's no playbook that I could find, or my business partners can find, on how to start a coffee importation, exportation, sourcing business. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of YouTube videos on it. Definitely not specifically with how to source it from Colombians in Colombia and doing that part of the deal. And, you know, it's also really hard because we didn't come and grow up from the coffee scene. Like, I am an IT data center nerd. Right. My other business partner is an active duty Marine. My other business partner comes from a construction background. So it's not like I know the roaster at XYZ Roaster in North Carolina, who's my best friend or anything. So one of the things we first started doing was, even before the coffee shipped, was talking to roasters. You know, I travel a lot for work, and I go into every single specialty coffee shop I can possibly go on, every trip I go, and making friends, right? And that's what I've been doing. And as I tell my story, they love it. They can't wait for the coffee. But finally, I had the coffee here. So now it was sending all these people coffee. And kind of using a little bit of my sales background, where starting that sales funnel. I have my leads. You know, these people were interested. These people were kind of interested. These are warm leads. These are people who I've been keeping up with. You know, how much do we send them was a big question that we were debating internally forever. I got mixed feedback from roasters. You know, you want to send me 500 because I don't have a small sample roaster. Or no, I have an Ikawa 50 or an Ikawa 100. You could send me, 200, 250, because, you know, send me more than that would be a waste. I've gotten a lot of mixed reception on that. I'd love to get your feedback on that too, right? Yeah. So that was one thing that we did. The other thing we did was we also had some roasted to give to roasters who had issues with sample roasting. We saw that as a kind of common theme as we talked to some smaller roasters that said, you know, we don't have an Ikawa. If you don't send me 500, it's going to be really difficult for me to throw it in here and be able to do 3, 4, 5 test batches and dial it in. Here's a bag of roasted coffee. It's like, oh, you just shortcutted this for me. You didn't give me homework.
Yeah.
you know, you've given me the pleasure of drinking the coffee and letting me cup it. Some roasters do want the homework. Some roasters did not want the headache, but they wanted to try it in order to commit or not to, to buying green coffee. So that's kind of the first couple of things. And then setting up the e-store. You know, that was really what took a lot of the time, was how are we going to sell this, present it? How much of the coffee are we going to split between our own roasted coffee that will eventually get private labeled, which we're doing now,
yeah,
versus how much are we going to sell to roasters?
That's awesome, man. So what has been, you guys, when did you start sending out all the samples? I feel like I was one of your first people to get a sample. Is that right?
You were definitely one of the first ones. I think you were literally the first one to get that box. So much so that I think we didn't get you an extra little pamphlet that we stuck in there.
Dude, I was blown away. I, like, obviously I've been roasting for, I think, 8 years now. I've gotten a lot of samples and a lot of things sent to me. And typically it's like you get a FedEx bag that has like a sticker slapped over a clear plastic bag. Like, that's it. It's like, sweet, like, got my sample, you know? And so I like got this like really beautiful box and I opened it up and like the presentation like blew me out. I was like, man, these guys are crushing it, because that, it does set a standard that you care about the product that you're bringing me, right? Like, I'm big on aesthetics, I'm big on packaging, and I think that I value the coffee that I'm giving out to customers and our subscription and all that kind of stuff. Like, I want someone to be excited when they get a jar of our coffee. Like, man, this is like, they put time into the label and into the jar and into everything. Mm-hmm. And because they care and they know that their product is valued, right? And that doesn't just mean that it costs a lot of money, right? I think often, exactly, in the specialty coffee industry, if it's not like $22 for, you know, 8 ounces of coffee, you're like, oh, this must suck. Like, well, not necessarily. Like, I don't have a huge personal budget to like blow on coffee all the time, which is part of the reason I got into it. But like the packaging, the image and everything like does matter. And so, yeah, I was blown away and I was like, man, without even, I haven't sample roasted it yet, obviously, because I wanted to wait until we did this show. But I was like, man, this coffee is going to be great. Because you have shown in your story and the like impact in the packaging is evident that like you guys care about the process, you care about the coffee you're doing, you know, you're wanting to impact your community that you grew up in, and it's evident with everything you've done so far, man. So good work, bro. You've crushed it.
Really appreciate that. Again, who, not how. That was not me. I am not artistic. Yeah. That's somebody that we partnered with. Her name is Julie. She's amazing. Mm. She, you know, she bought into the story and the value. She's an artist. She does artist stuff. And she put that together like it was nothing. I'm like, do you know how long that would have taken me to do that? That's incredible. And we really want to, you know, as the new guys and trying to get into this market, we wanna wow people. We wanna, you know, if you get, you know, from our, I'll tell you what our perspective is. Like, what's gonna get someone when they get the stuff in the mail? If we send this cold with no lead, what could possibly make them want to open that box and roast their coffee? You know, first, it's got to look good, you know, at least have a great box or at least great presentation. So that's in our control. And it wasn't that hard to do. It's not that costly. It's worth every penny. And, you know, I'm glad. I'm super stoked to get the feedback. And, you know, hopefully when you roast the coffee, you'll, you know, it's worth the box. It's worth the presentation that it came in.
Right. No, that's awesome. So you're getting samples out. Obviously, if there's any roasters listening, be sure to check it out. You can get samples on your website. You guys have 3 or 4 coffees now. Is that right? That you can get
samples of? We have 3 coffees that you could get samples of. 2 are from our producer partner from Sierra Gutierrez in Quindío. Another one is a Geisha that I had sourced with my partner Juan Diaz in Colombia. And that one's not from Quindío. Okay. We have a very limited supply of that one, but the most that we have is of the carbonic maceration and of the fully washed process that Sarah has.
So, yeah, I don't want to say this because I haven't sample roasted yet, but I imagine if any of our subscribers or people that buy our coffee, you'll be seeing a carbonic maceration from Sarah Gutierrez here coming soon. So I'm super excited about that coffee, man. It sounds amazing. Speaking of which, I reminded myself earlier that I wasn't going to forget to ask you, let's talk about this carbonic maceration. She's using some of the juices that were processed from, just explain it, because I'm going to screw it up if I try to ask it.
Sure. So Sarah, again, microbiologist, And one of the many experiments that she's done over the years that she's now fine-tuned, created protocols for to be repeatable and constantly get the flavor profile that she wants, the scoring that she needs. One of them is that she's calling, it's called a Pink Castillo. Okay. So it's the Castillo varietal, but in the processing, she uses the mosto. And if anybody looks up mosto, M-O-S-T-O, okay. It's kind of like this juice, this leftover juice from the fermentation process. Mm. She's using that from a pink Bourbon, from a lot of pink Bourbon.
Yeah.
So she's getting tropical papaya, pineapple, and a lot of yellow fruit flavors, like star fruit. But she's getting some florals. Jasmine is one of the ones that she has in her description. It's silky body with a medium juicy acidity. It's getting an 87 score, and it's pretty wild because I think of it like a crossbreeding where the pink Bourbon fermentated, this mosto, is being put into a different varietal.
Yeah.
So it's grabbing yeast and bacteria, which has its own specific flavors and notes from one varietal, and then mixing them into a whole other varietal's yeast and bacteria as well. It's fermenting. It's pretty wild.
Dude, that's amazing. My mouth is literally watering as you're describing that coffee. So I'm excited, man, that the tasting notes and everything just sound amazing. And it's cool because there's few, I think you guys are uniquely positioned because there's few people that can communicate to the specialty coffee industry, the producing, the milling, the purchasing of a farm. Like, your guys' story is impactful, and it's like you can communicate and relate to people here, as well as your family is from Cadeo. Like, that's your hometown. That's where, you know, you travel there all the time. Your dad still lives there. So it's impactful, just your story and what you're doing there, and everything. So, man, I'm excited, bro.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. The carbonic maceration that you have, that was really interesting because it comes from winemaking techniques where they are doing a anaerobic fermentation. Mm-hmm. It's also a natural process. There's different, you can have a honey or a wash process too, but the typical one that we hear about, it's a natural process, carbonic maceration. So with that fruit still on this cherry, on the seed, it's put into tanks. And if you imagine like a, if you ever seen beer being made and fermented, where there's like a one-way valve that shoots out and you maintain pressure with carbon dioxide and oxygen going out, that's similar. It's almost very, very similar to the same thing she's doing in these tanks. She's keeping it at the right, she's hitting her numbers on what she needs to see every day on these tanks to be able to get these flavor notes that she has. And so when I first drank it, I thought I was drinking wine. It was very winey. But also it's really, really flavorful on the berries. Like, everybody says it tastes like strawberry or raspberries. And so the shop in Charleston, South Carolina, they're our first customers who bought this carbonic maceration. They're calling it the Southern Berry. I actually have a bag here. Shout out to Coastal Coffee Roasters. You're showing it here on the camera, but it's called Southern Berry for our Charleston friends in the South. And they're saying it tastes like blueberry and, you know, put it on some toast. And
oh, man. Yeah, I'm excited. That's right. Like, those are the types of coffees that I source most often. I think our flavor profile is typically like juicy, you know, kind of in that middle ground, berry forward, a lot of tropical notes. And so, and I love the, like, the anaerobic processed, you know, all that kind of stuff. And so I'm super excited to try that. And then you guys just roasted some of the coffee with that partnership. And I just saw you guys just launched, what was that, yesterday or the day before, right? Your
just launched Saturday morning, I believe it went live. Yep.
Yeah. And you sold 100 bags of coffee.
We did. We did. A couple of those orders were really big orders, you know, 20 bags or 30 bags. So that definitely helped. But again, like, friends and family have been asking me for years, and my business partners for almost over a year now, like, I want to buy some coffee. And it's like, hey, mom and dad, you're not a green coffee roaster. You can't buy our coffee yet. We got to get you to a shop that's going to buy green coffee to buy it. But now we kind of solved that problem. So we had some people ready.
Regardless of the fact, man, there's few. I think if you were to pool coffee roasters in their first launch of a coffee, to sell 100 bags is crazy. So, I mean, that's when I saw that, I was like, is this for real? Like, are these guys sold 100 bags? Regardless of if someone bought 30 or 20 bags or not, man, like even to sell 50 or 25 on your first launch, I think is impressive, and you know, it means you guys are doing something right. So, congrats on
Yeah,
that
thank you.
launch.
Thank
That's
you.
awesome, dude. So you're starting to get samples out. You've roasted some coffee. You're selling a bunch of it, which is amazing. What's kind of the next steps? What's your future kind of looking at as you progress, and what have you learned kind of looking back on the after you've brought your first lot in and everything like that?
So first things first, what keeps me up the most and is taking specifically me and my partnership with three business owners is I'm the head on everything that's happening in Colombia with our Colombian business, right? So number one is getting this wet and dry mill up and running before the harvest, the main harvest, I'm sorry, the first harvest in Colombia. So Colombia has two harvests, one around April-ish timeframe. It varies weather, what region you are. So I'm just using, kind of ballparks here, right? One basically like around April, one basically around October, September, November, somewhere in that time range. The big one is the later in the year. So the wet mill, we got to get this up and running before that harvest so that when all this coffee starts getting grown, we can collect it, buy it, and start producing it in order to be able to really make some huge numbers there in Colombia on the wet mill side. And then the dry mill is being built now, right? We bought all the machinery. All the machinery. We just have to retrofit this old mill, which did not have a dry mill. It was only a wet mill. We have to retrofit it for dry milling. Things like these giant elevators that move the coffee from one stage to the next, they're really, really tall. So you have to raise the roof in certain parts. You have to put dust filters and stuff like that. Brand new electrical, because the electrical was from freaking like 15 years ago, and it's a fire hazard if we were to turn it on. So yeah, that's primary what's next. At the same time, it's working with producers like Sarah on connecting her and her coffee, some of these, more exotic product protocols that she has a very smaller quantity of, but also she has a larger quantity of her typical wash and her carbonic. It's getting her coffee sold and, putting, we have many hats here, and one of them is that importer exporter role. And so getting her coffee sold. We're having some really great conversations with this firm based out of St. Louis who's looking to buy, I mean, in their words, right? As much coffee as she can make. So,
That's awesome.
we're talking numbers and we're talking about that partnership. We introduced them to Sarah just on Friday, and it was a great call. And having it's by far the probably my favorite things I do is when I get on a phone call with Sarah. With American roasters, and I help translate between the two whenever she gets stuck with words in English, or they speak Spanglish and they get stuck, and I get to help them. It's just seeing the both of them how happy they get to be able to make that connection. It's absolutely one of my favorite parts about doing this. So that's definitely our next big thing is getting her a lot of coffee that she harvested in these last few months and starting to get it sold and shipped.
That's awesome. So your goal is to have it ready by April time frame so that when that first harvest hits 2024, you guys are off to the races with the wet and dry mill.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, the dry mill doesn't take that long to be fully operational. There's farmers like Sarah who have their coffee sitting in their own warehousing in parchment form. And as customers ask them, "Hey, send me a container here, send me a pallet, send me, two bags," whatever their sizes are, that's when they go send it to dry mill.
Got it.
Right? Because once you dry mill it, then it's export ready. So we want to be up and running with the dry mill fine-tune and servicing Quindío ASAP, and that we're looking at. One thing about Colombians, we take a very long holiday break. So, they're starting now, but once the middle of December turns around, work is going to be slow, if not happening at all for like 2 weeks. So, probably in the beginning of January, we're estimating that we'll be able to start dry milling.
Awesome, man. That's amazing. So, dry milling beginning of January, hoping to have the wet mill up and running come February timeframe, March, April, and then you guys are off to the races. So, that's
Absolutely. In
amazing.
the meantime, trying to in the meantime, just selling coffee from other producers, not our own, and passing along and bringing it to the US market.
That's awesome. So tell me about this Airbnb future goal that you have. We talked about it briefly before we started this episode, and I was like, man, I've never been to Origin. I know a lot of roasters and, you know, coffee professionals they go yearly or multiple times a year even, and, you know, they create these direct relationships, and that's always been a dream of mine. I've never gone to Origin. I've never been to a coffee farm. So when you said like, man, we're going to do an Airbnb, I was like, dude, I'm coming. So yeah, tell me what's up with this Airbnb plan.
Yeah. So, for those who don't know, Quindío is beautiful. It's gorgeous, just like you could possibly imagine being a coffee region. And it's pretty popular for ecotourism. And I had the vision of, you know, again, real estate was a really big part of everything I was doing here. My bigger vision was I'm going to combine the short-term rental market with owning a coffee farm, my own coffee farm, and then also a wet and dry mill.
Yeah.
And so as I broke that down, like, what's the quickest way to start producing profit? What's the quickest way to get this thing done? It's not the farm. It's not the Airbnbs and building the houses. It's the wet and dry mill. So that's what I'm doing first. But
gotcha.
Moving forward, one day we're going to have our own farm. Again, it has to have the right view with the roads and the whole thing. But we were looking at building tiny homes, almost like tiny homes. And you could YouTube this too. There's some pretty cool videos of going to Colombia and seeing examples of these, so I'm inspired by those, where there are steel frames, you know, you walk out the back patio and it's farm, it's not up, it's down, it's you're high up. Yeah. And you're almost kind of like not an infinity pool, but like with the feeling of an infinity pool.
Yeah.
We're gonna build a steel frame support structure that just has you just with a view you cannot possibly imagine, right? Imagine drinking your coffee in the morning and, yeah, but you're on farm. The farm.
Yeah.
That made the coffee that you're drinking that morning.
Yeah, it's a dream.
So it's the ultimate coffee drinker's, you know, dream. That's what I'm trying to do for myself, right? That's what I want, and that's what I want to build for other people.
Totally.
Also, there's ecotourism for things like extreme sports. People to go to this part of Colombia for hang gliding, paragliding. They do, you know, river rafting. But there's also a huge bird watching community that goes to Colombia.
Yeah.
There's some crazy statistics. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think it's like, you know, 70%, some huge number, like 70% of all the birds in the world, bird species in the world, can be found in Colombia.
Wow. Yeah,
it's a crazy number like that. I actually have it in one of my presentations I do. And then in particular, this region of Colombia, there's a very, very well-known bird watching kind of trail or landscape that you could do. So the one farm that we found, we were going to have some of the Airbnbs, we're going to build 10 of them. And we estimated $30,000 ballpark to build each one.
Yeah.
And again, not using loans, with a return on investment of like 3 years to be able to pay off the capital costs it would take to build them. And we're going to build 10 of them, with a couple of them being focused on a certain part of the wetland, rainforesty section that this one farm had, where it was going to be the bird watching Airbnbs. But we weren't going to do a big kitchen. We're going to do kind of a community pool, community hot pool, hot tub and pool. And the idea is, you know, you go there to be able to be close to, like, I have a picture here in the back of my office here of Salento.
Yeah.
Salento is really famous in Quindío for having the really tall palm trees. So still being close to some of the other tourist sites, kind of being like your hub as you go do more ecotourism, but having a place to stay. It's not a place that you're going to party in per se, right? It's a very small kind of spot to have, you know, some nice furnishings, but it's really just to lay your head, get a great breakfast, and then go about your journey.
Yeah, no, that's awesome, dude. So that was on a farm that you were looking at. What's your guys' plan for Airbnbs on the farm that you did purchase? Is it going to be that plan of 10, or is it something else?
No, we're not going to be doing any vacation homes on this farm.
Okay.
The owner, he's an older guy. He's like, look, I don't want this to turn into a party place. I don't want this to turn into, I want this just to be all about coffee. So he actually negotiated in our contract with him that we cannot host third parties. But I could bring trips to Origin for roaster partners, right? I can do business there. And we have a 3-bedroom home that came with the property. It's ours. We cleaned it up. We renovated it. So, you know, we we can have roasters come and clients of ours and obviously myself, if I'm going to go stay there at the farm. But it's not going to be for rent. It's not going to be on Airbnb or booking.com.
It would just be like, hey, this, you know, this roaster is looking at purchasing a lot of our coffee. He's going to come check out our farm and our mill. You know, he's going to stay here for the weekend and we'll show him around and do all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's awesome, man. Well, that's incredible. I'm excited for the next venture. And when I get to overlook your coffee farm and drink coffee that was grown there, I mean, that's a dream, like you're saying, man. That's exciting. So,
hey, April, what you got a passport ready? Let's go. Let's April, I'm going back.
Okay. Yeah, I'm in. Don't tempt me.
I'll put you on the spot.
Yeah. It's, hey, listen, as long as you don't tell my wife that it's a huge bird watching area, we can keep that between us. She's terrified of birds, which.
No. There's no birds. I never said that. Yeah.
Good. Yeah. She's in. We're in.
What about hummingbirds? Is she scared of hummingbirds? They're pretty awesome.
No, hummingbirds less so.
We have a hummingbird friend in our farm right now. He has a little hummingbird feeder. He's always around there.
Yeah.
So
yeah, she's good. She can do the hummingbirds. You know, it's the big, like, you know, she's going to be mad that I'm even talking about her bird phobia on here. But, anyway, she's done better ever since we had kids. She's made big strides, 'cause you know, she can't show the fear to her kids and all that kind of stuff. But anyways.
Well, let's sell her on the food. Let's sell her on the amazing views, the great hospitality.
Listen, you don't have to sell me at all. I think it would take very little convincing. I think I'll have to say the one word, which is vacation, and she'll go, where are we going? I'll say Colombia. She goes, okay, let's go. So, but no,
perfect.
That sounds amazing, man. So how are you managing it all? I know you've talked a lot about outsourcing, but for someone, there's a lot of things out there in the specialty coffee industry on like how to start a coffee cart, how to start a, you know, a roastery or whatever. And this season is of the specialty coffee podcast, we're going to focus on like doing coffee differently. And I can't think of a better guest than you, 'cause I don't know anyone that's doing what you're doing. So what would be some tips and keys to give, or like lessons you've learned the hard way from someone who's gone really from no coffee experience prior to then owning a farm and mill and all that kind of stuff? Like what would you say if you were to write a guidebook or some keys to give to people?
The first thing is, what are you after? And then find those people that are doing some of the things that you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, I saw, you know, like, so I look at things like Onyx Coffee or Black and White Roasters, or you know, some of the roasters in New Hampshire. I started going to coffee shops around there for some of my Navy trips. Some of the shops in Cali. I was seeing the differentiators between what coffee were they selling, looking at the bags, and seeing how much value were they bringing from the farmers. That is what I want to do, or what I want to partner with roasters to provide them, right? Mm-hmm. And then as I did that, networking my ass off. Because I saw very quickly, wow, everybody in this coffee industry is really freaking nice and really, really open. Is I guess as long as you're maybe as enthusiastic as I am about it, but it just seems like everybody's very willing to lend a hand and help. So, you know, I just networked my butt off. Instagram was a huge venue or way tool to do that. You know, using some hashtags to try to find those people, using, you know, starting to follow some of the people that I've been seeing in the scene. That's how I found Juan Diaz. That's how you and I first started really having some of our conversations. Rob, YouTube was a big part of that as well. You know, as I started looking into, you know, my first search was how to start a coffee farm in Colombia and then sell it to, like, there's not a lot of, you know, pre-made YouTube, a blueprint on YouTube on how to start a coffee farm from scratch in Colombia. Right, so, but if you're doing something different than what I was doing, I bet you find some great videos to at least, again, find that avatar, find that person who you can model and say, those are some things that I want to do. Network, reach out. You'd be surprised how much people are willing to give their time in this industry. And again, I'm just talking, I've only been doing this for 2 years. So
yeah,
I'm sure you feel the same way.
No, yeah, absolutely. It's amazing what you've accomplished in such a short time, man. I mean, I feel like you should be writing a book and a guideline.
You're making me blush over here. I don't really think I've done that much, but thank you.
No, I'm not. I'm not trying to overhype you or anything like that. It is just impressive to me. Like, obviously, you've partnered with the right people, and I think that's something that I've learned even in my short time of like being in the coffee industry. Is like, man, I'm good at certain aspects of certain things. But there are people that are doing things way better than I am. And I should just partner with those people and say, hey, like, do you want to join forces? What can I learn from you? How can we, you know, collaborate and do things? And I think the specialty coffee industry is what makes it so unique and special, is that everyone wants to push the industry forward and make it better and more welcoming and open. And so, you know, I think there's very few people that are like wanting to keep trade secrets hush hush and like, no, this is me. Like, I don't want to, you know, this is what I'm doing. I think that's a thing of the past. And there's so much of like, you know, Mauricio's like, he's purchased a farm. Like, you gotta, you know, like, I've been trying to push your name out there and people are excited about what you guys are doing. And so, it's cool to see, the
partnership is
openness
so. For sure. Critical. And I was kicking and screaming for, my buddy, who's now my business partner, Tucker, keeps kicking and screaming for over a year. Like, you gotta let me help you. You got to let me be a part of this. Come on, man. I'm like, no, I'm going to do this myself. And then finally, after a year, he's like, I'm doing this. Like, I will be helping you. And I'm like, fine. Okay, fine.
Sure.
And that's what opened the rabbit hole. Then I was able to bring in more partners. And without them, I would not be here today. I'm good at some things. I'm really terrible at others. They're good at some things. They're really terrible at others. You know, I bring sales. They're not in sales. I'm in sales. So I bring some perspectives that they don't. It's a really great mix. Try not to find partners that are people like you. Try to find partners that are different than you. You don't want to find the same thing. It's not duplicating. You want to be well-rounded. And so that's definitely another thing I would recommend. And then I would also say, make sure you're doing it for the right reasons. You know, I would not be doing this coffee business if it was strictly because I think it's a great way to make money. There's a lot better ways to make money as a business owner. I would think, and I, you know, we can make an argument about that, but the capital also is another thing, is making sure you have your capital really, really well thought out. Don't start a business without having your capital figured out where it's going to come from.
Right.
It'll put you in some really sticky situations, and you want to be well prepared for that. So that's another thing, is as for anyone trying to get into this, or how did I get where I am, is we put a lot of thought about how we're going to raise the money to do this.
Yeah. How was it from your prior, like, real estate ventures, you were able to raise capital? What was kind of the way that you were able to prepare yourself for the venture that you launched into?
Yeah, for the most part right now, this is all self-funded. That's between amazing. Myself and my two business partners. It's mostly self-funded. We've taken some small loans here and there from some closer people, right? Some within our own circles, but right. The original tool that we were going to use to do this project, the bigger project, the $1 million raise that we're going to need to do all three phases, was through a real estate tool called syndication. Mm-hmm. And that's the way, like, how I was pitched a couple years ago and asked to be a passive investor. It's the way passive investments are done in the real estate world for things like apartment buildings, mobile home parks. But then as we started limiting or shrinking the original scope of what we're going to do. We're just going to do this abandoned facility. We don't have to build from scratch. Yeah. We're just going to do a wet and dry mill. We didn't need that much capital anymore. So that we may or may not do that later and do a big fundraise. But for now, this is just pretty much self-funded.
That's amazing. Yeah. No, it's cool that you guys have, you know, accomplished what you've set out to do, and, you know, you're doing it, man. So how can people reach you and find you if roasters are listening or other coffee professionals? Obviously, you know, I don't want to overcommit or commit too soon, but I think very soon we'll be seeing some carbonic maceration from Storyline coffee roasters hitting it. So for any listeners that are, you know, getting Storyline, you can expect to see that, which will come first to our subscription. And I think one thing, I'm squirreling here, so bear with me, listeners and Mauricio. One thing I love that you said earlier was just like, you can tell that you're passionate about the things that you're doing, and that's why it's being successful, right? Like, people often ask me about our subscription. They're like, dude, how are you making money on this? Like, and you're one of our subscribers, so thank you for your support. But like, that's a question I get asked often is like, dude, it's $20. You get coffee, content, and gear. Like, how are you making a profit on that? And for me, it's really like, man, I'm super passionate, and like, I get jazzed. Like, in my free time, I would just nerd out on like coffee gear, and like, that's what I'd look up on Instagram. And like, and so I'd be like, man, it'd be so cool if I could buy this. And convincing my wife to get a bigger kitchen to fit all this coffee gear in is hard to do, and to keep spending money on it. So I was like, man, I would want to buy this if I could just do it and not think about it. And the subscription was a way for me to do that. Like, I just always buy one extra and I keep it. And so like, that's what,
self-serving. Yeah. I love it.
It is. Yeah. But it's also like, man, if I'm excited about this gear we're bringing out, then so are other people, right? Like, if I'm excited about these jars, so are other people. Like, your packaging, your coffee, your processing, like what you're doing with the Airbnbs, like, you're passionate about it, and other people are then going to be passionate about it. And I think that's the, one of the keys to business is like, man, if you're jazzed and have so much energy behind something, people are going to see that and want to be a part of that and be like, man, why is this guy like so into milling and processing and all this kind of stuff? Like, well, it's because he cares about it, and I want to get a part of that. So, anyways, that was a huge rabbit hole.
Absolutely. But how do I translate that as a green coffee importer and provider to roasters? How do I translate that? And that's something that we're still figuring out. Yeah. You know, on our e-commerce side, like, I can envision where we'll have a lot more content or things per coffee that we sell or that we source to help you as the roaster say, oh man, these guys, you know, look at Mauricio and look at their partners. They went to Colombia. Look at these great videos. Look at this video from the producer herself or himself.
Yep.
Talking about the process. So, you know, we have a long way to go and a ton of improvements to make on our e-site to help facilitate that. But that's what we're thinking too, is how do we translate my excitement and my partner's excitement about what we're doing? You know, how do I bottle up and reproduce 100 times over what just happened on my call with this latest interaction I had between a roaster and Sarah, my first coffee producing partner, right?
Yeah.
How do I repurpose that and do it over and over again, and without having to be there for every single call? That's right. Some of the things we're thinking too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think one, like, this podcast, people are going to see the passion and your vision and your like high quality standards and everything like that. I would also say, like, dude, I would love one to get Sarah on here. Like, we could do a 3-way video podcast. That would be super cool, just to hear from her and like the processing methods and what she sees for the future, but also just like short videos of Sarah talking about the carbonic maceration and that process, to then be able to show customers like, hey, like, your explanation of the coffee I was about to drink and roast and then drink, obviously, like, made my mouth water. Like, I think that's what connects and makes specialty coffee different. Is people, it's not just your morning caffeine jolt. It's this, you're stepping into something that is more than just your morning wake up. You know, there's the process of your coffee getting rerouted. There's all these nuanced elements that make it special. And you realize that you're holding something that is like, wow, this is crazy that I'm actually holding this coffee. And I think that's why direct partnerships are important. But marketing that to the end consumer can be tricky. But right. Having a good, convenient way to say like, hey, here's a 30-second sound clip of this coffee and how it was produced from this farmer. Here's our importer and everything. And I think that goes a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. Now it's putting that pen on paper, getting someone to record me talking about it, or then also having Sarah do her own videos. And so it's again, it goes back to who, not how, like who do I need to find that's good at that portion of it? Cause I'm not, nor should it be a good use of my time to try to figure out how to do a video studio you know, how to edit a video. Yeah. I could do it, but how long would it take me versus somebody else?
Totally, dude. Yeah, that's it, man. And I think it's so much simpler than people make it out to be, right? Like, I watched this video recently. It's like, what's the biggest lie you've been ever told? and it's that it's not that simple. Like, that's the biggest lie. The reality is like, if you just do it, right? And I think that's what's powerful about your story is you just did it. Like, you found a way, you partner with the right people, and you set out to do something, and you accomplished it, man. And it's not as complex as people make it out to be, and you learn a hell of a lot along the way. So
I do like getting that question now, you know, fast forward so many years later. How did you do this? How are you doing this? What? How? You know, some friends or coworkers and stuff. I'm like, well, I don't watch that much TV. I wake up early. I eat well. I exercise. I have, a pretty good diet to keep me energized. And I do have 5 kids. So I do. I take care of my family. I'm a family man first. Yep. But when they're in bed, you know, I'm grinding. It's just work. It's just a lot of work.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I have a goal in mind. In order to accomplish it, I know I have to do what's necessary. So
that's awesome. Well, man, how can people connect with you? How can they get samples? What's your website, Instagram handle? And how can they buy some of your tasty coffee?
Yes. Yeah, so BoteroCoffeeClub.com, BOTERO, like the famous painter. That's first and foremost, that's the best way to find us to get our coffee. We have our samples on there. There's $0 to be able to buy them, but you do have to pay for shipping. And then also we have our roasted coffee on there as well. You should be able to buy it there as well. We are also on Instagram, so at Botero Coffee Club. That's where we're putting a lot of our content, both videos and descriptions about the coffee itself. And also some really cool, you know, art stuff about us making coffee and things like that. My email address, that's probably the best way to contact me directly, is my first name, Mauricio, Mauricio@BoteroCoffeeClub.com. And then from there, we can get you in touch with the right person.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. Well, Mauricio, thank you so much for coming on, man. This was something that I have been wanting to do, is get a coffee farmer, and you're it, man. So thank you so much for coming on the episode. And we'll be launching a carbonic maceration for Storyline here shortly. So stoked to get it roasted and cupped, and then we'll get a bag coming our way. So
sounds like a plan. Can't wait to drink it.
Awesome, bro. Well, thanks again so much. And we'll be sure to stay in touch.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you very much.